The memoir itself is like, with that, I actually go lean into embracing how I was taught to deceive as for survival.
Yeah. Right. Hi, I'm Bianca Stone. Welcome to the Ruth Stone House podcast. I'm thrilled to be today. I'm thrilled today to be talking with the poet Shanta Lee Gander. Hello, Shanta.
Hi, Bianca.
Shanta Lee Gander is not just a poet. She's an artist and multifaceted professional. Her endeavors include writing and photography with work that has been featured in Prism, Iterant Magazine, Paulette Poetry, and others. She is also very active in photojournalism here in Vermont. She's been featured on Vermont Public Radio, and her investigative reporting has been in the Commons Weekly newspaper covering Windham County, Vermont. She also gives lectures on the life of Lucy Terry Prince, considered the first known African-American poet in literature, as a member of the Vermont Humanities Council Speakers Bureau, and is the 2020 gubernatorial appointee to their board of directors. That's something I'm very excited about. Shanta's also an MFA candidate in creative nonfiction and poetry at Vermont College of Fine Arts. And we're talking today about her first book, which just came out hot off the press, Ghetto Claustrophobia, from Diode Editions. Welcome, Shanta.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so psyched.
Me too. And I'm just like, what a treasure you are in Vermont, and what a treasure this book is. And I'm just like, I just feel like it's really an honor to have connected with you and really developed this relationship with you. Shanta just did a class with the Ruth Stonehouse classroom as well, which was a roaring success and was really, really fun.
That was so exciting.
Yeah, it really was. I listened into a couple of them and it was really, really, really awesome. So I wanted to talk about Ghetto Claustrophobia a little bit, just to start us off talking about the title of the book and a little bit of the impetus behind how it all came to be.
That's a really good question. So it's funny because in 2018, just before I entered into the Vermont College of Fine Arts, I think that was the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein, something like that. And so my husband and I,
I always remember.
Yeah, yeah, right. Right. And we did like a write-in, and we tried to like kind of mimic that, you know, minus not being on Lake Geneva and all that good stuff.
Right.
So some of the stuff that came out of that.
So you were doing like kind of what, how Frankenstein came to be, which is that they were all trapped
in the
together.
House. Yeah, together and kind of challenging each other, even though Lord Byron was just like, you know, come up with the scariest, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And so, you know, we had a Goblin Market, we had some passages from Frankenstein, and it was like sort of like a birthday to myself, like all this weird stuff, like all tied in. And some of the stuff that came out of that, I hadn't really noticed that I didn't really write much about my experiences of growing up in Hartford, like in poem form, or like, what was it like to be at 280 Collins Street in this building that feels like it just wraps around and like it feels endless. Like it showed up in my dreams, but it wasn't. So then I remember, I think it was like when I got finished, like going to one of the lectures at VCFA. So a couple of months later, and saying to my husband, because he's a poet as well and journalist, and I said, oh, I would love to be able to submit for a contest or something. And he was like, well, you need a whole poetry collection. I was like, well, how many pages is that? Right, like kind of like that. Even though I've been writing poetry since I was way young to understand what that meant.
Yeah, it's way different when you're like, okay, putting a book together. Everything changes.
Everything changes. And so what I decided to do at the end of 2018, I said, okay, I need to do a work on a collection, but not count all the pieces as I'm working towards what, 50, 60, 70 pages or more, like right. just do it. So we did a couple more of these write-ins, and I just, without forcing it, also thinking about some of the subject matter, looking at what came out of the Frankenstein weekend, letting it sit for a long time, and then circling back and saying, okay, I need to do this. And so during my first poetry semester, actually, it forced me to work on this manuscript and another manuscript. Like, I forced myself to come out of grad school with several manuscripts and got more than what I bargained for. And so when it actually, like, thinking about, then I was like, okay, ghetto claustrophobia. Like, what does that mean? And that, like, the bigger title is Ghetto Claustrophobia, Dreaming of Mama While Trying to Speak Woman in Woke Tongues. Mm-hmm. Because some of the themes and the threads. And yeah, so that's kind of, it was sort of like, oh, I guess I need to be thinking about what a collection looks like and what an arc looks like.
Right. Right. It's interesting because, you know, you probably had some poems already and, you know, that you could work off of, but really, like, thinking about the themes and writing into them can be, like, very productive. You know, people are a little scared of that. They shy away from it a lot of the times, but actually, you know, because I think we have anxiety, you know, some people can go in the other direction and have no anxiety about making a poetry book into a project and sort of, like, overdo that. Right. But I think more so, I've noticed that people, like, don't bring their themes up more, you know, mm-hmm. don't own their themes more and don't write towards it more. Mm-hmm. Whereas really it's just like a mindfulness of, like, what interests you, you know, and, like, even just challenging yourself to think about things that are hard to think about.
No, I agree with you 100%, because that was a part of it too, like, coming to a certain point. I think it was, like, right at the beginning of that poetry semester, I think, like, the third semester in or something. So what, last year? Yeah, last spring. And looking, then allowing myself to look at all of it. There was even a whole section called Ghetto Claustrophobians. And my husband was like, yeah, no, he was like that. Cause like, he's one of my many editors. And he was just like, yeah, it's not quite for it. I was like, okay. You know, so putting that aside, but then thinking about flow. And then he said, well, think about it as smaller books too, like, so originally it was supposed to be a chapbook, mm-hmm, and invited mm-hmm. me to make it a full collection. I said, I got that.
Yeah. Wait, no, I'm not gonna do
that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
Yeah, yeah,
I remember that now.
Yeah, you remember that, right?
Yeah, I forgot about that.
You still write about writing into the themes, because it was like that. That was the other thing too, not being afraid to lean into what that is, you know.
Well, you have such strong sections too, that I noticed that, and, like, I love your section titles, and I love how you're having so much fun with language and, like, playing with the different ways that ghetto claustrophobia can be used.
Yeah.
And I guess in that way, you know, like, thinking about your sections of your book as chat books that all speak to one another, mm-hmm, is another really helpful way to get a manuscript, you know, get a good manuscript done.
Mm-hmm. Well, because then that way it doesn't feel so daunting.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, so I kind of tricked myself by saying, don't count how many poems you have towards that, and look at what you have, and also think of them almost exactly like smaller chat books, and what could that be together in the bigger whole.
Yeah. Well, there's so much in this book, particularly about heritage. You talked a little bit about, you know, Hartford and being, you know, where you're from, but mm-hmm. Particularly the mother is a very strong presence in this book. And there's, you know, what I found very striking is the tension in the voice and allusions to the mother and mothers and generations of mothers. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak about the complexities of the mother, and how you found that that was something you could explore in poetry, and what vehicles you use in order to explore those, you know, safely.
That's a very good question. This was years ago. I remember talking to someone and they made this statement, like, it all goes back to mother, you know, thinking about, like, you know, growing up watching Mommy Dearest, mm-hmm, and then thinking about the complicated relationship I have with my mother, other people may have with their mothers and parents, and the ways that for generations there seem in my family, there's at least on my mother's side, my father's side is very interesting in its own way. On my mother's side, it's like it felt like there were these generations of complexity and rifts between women, where when I first met my great grandmother, who's like long deceased, but when I met her years ago, I think it was for graduation or something, my mother lectured me about not taking anything from her. I was not to trust this woman. Like I got a harsh lecture. Yeah, she hated this woman. And the only thing I remember ever hearing about great grandma Josephine was like some bullwhip or something she kept to set you right. She had 16 children. She gave birth to 16 children.
Damn.
Like she was like,
maybe she had to have a bullwhip. No,
I was about to say like you had, or a horse whip. She had something where it was like,
yikes,
you know, you better come to breakfast at a certain time. But then over time, and I think it was through my work around Lucy Terry Prince and some other stuff where I was thinking, I want to know more about my family stories. And as I started writing my memoir and thinking about that, I was like, oh my, I want to dig more. So I started, I actually have someone who's an uncle cousin. No joke. But like I have an uncle cousin to say, because he had some answers. And then these stories. My mother and I have this on again, off again. My parents are still married, but on again, off again, you know, she'll disappear and then she'll surface and it'll be really dramatic. So several months ago, she was telling me the backstory of like having to leave down south in a hurry when her and my aunt were down there because they were going to get their ass whooped by my great grandmother and all this. And then I remember asking one of my aunts, well, who was great grandma Josephine's favorite? She has 16 children.
Right.
I was like, was grandma, you know, my grandma Leola, was she the favorite? Nope, she was the favorite. I'm like, ooh, that might explain a lot. I mean, just interesting. And you asked a good question, because did I know whether or not I could explore? Not necessarily. Like, not necessarily. I hadn't talked about my family in such a way in poem form. Like it would happen in prose form, or, you know, lifelong person who writes in their journal, you know, right. I could do it in prose, I could do it, but then to talk about my mother and her shame and inheriting shame and inheriting angst, like this deep riff. I don't have children, but one of my fears was, well, am I going to pass that on to a daughter if I have one? Like,
because
here I am, I would be telling my kid, hey, be careful, grandma, you're not going to know grandma.
Right.
That whole.
Right. I mean, even just writing about it in a book is, there's something almost similar too. It's like, okay, beware of grandma, like in this book, but it's, you know, because it's not direct, because it's not basing itself on narrative, that I feel like in that way you're able to get at and allude to all these great generational complexities that aren't cut and dry. Like, you know, we always think like poems, you know, I feel like the default assumption is that when we write about our mothers, we write about how strong they are, right?
Right.
But I think as, you know, a daughter of a complex mother who's not all great, that one finds that poetry is a perfect vehicle to explore these complexities, because it's never going to be complex for the person who is born having to love their mother, just nature-wise, you know?
Right.
So that complexity will always be there, that duality between loving and hating them. And that, especially if there's generations of that.
Like my mother drove me crazy. And she also, she in and of herself has a mental health issue that no one will talk about.
Yeah.
You know, like something's wrong with Denise. And so there's also that too. Like when I talk about looking in my rear view, and it's a sort of like checking for, did I inherit some of this and the rage, and then trying to understand why she may have been so rageful and upset. And at the same time, not quite saying I love my mother, like Mother's Day.
I know. I mean, there's some lines that are just really chilling. There's in the poem Lessons in Development from a Butterfly. Let me see, she'll demand, putting me on the road to be somebody's pretty baby. T-shirts will be no more a protection than mothers and witnesses who collude, encouraging, go ahead, teaching how to memorize the answer to this question. Is this what a hug means in their language? I mean, it's chilling in its implications, and its complexities and its sorrows. And there's so much about the child in this book, throughout time, through different ages. I mean, 7 and 12 seems to be like a recurring ages, but I think that, so you're writing a memoir, this is separate than this project, but clearly that's informing this book. Which yeah, is great,
in some odd right? way it does, because it's like the memoir itself is like, with that, I actually go lean into embracing how I was taught to deceive for survival.
Yeah. Right. There's and so much. I loved that you touched on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Being told what to say, what to do, and to be quiet, you know, and to not express what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
To continue the cycle of abuse, you know, it's like, yeah. It's like, you're okay, we're all gonna like take part in this family tradition, right, of like continuing the cycle of abuse.
Yes,
like
line up for some. And then like for me, it became about embracing it as a shape-shifting tool, if that makes any sense. And like the more that I was digging into like Black history and all that and heritage and thinking about, you do certain shit for survival because you don't want to lose your life.
That's like the whole other dimension to it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, the Black women's history that's also in there.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, filled with complexities and hurt and pain and rage.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love it if you read a poem from the book.
I would love to.
Put this all in context.
Yes. I'm going to read Mother Who Brung Ya 3. Page 30. Some say, mama's 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 mama, some kind of medicine woman. Or was it she made balm? She made for estranged souls. A tangled tale on mama's side about how all the men lost, eaten. How all the men got no names, well, few. Mama's grandfather went by Sing. Mama's great-grandfather, full name, the women. They be the kind refusing unknowing, as in they got names, as in follow the trail of chicken feet, follow all the ways we know seeing with our eyes closed. One of Papa's great-grandmamas, a Cherokee woman. Papa's great-grandpapa, a white man. Both them, no name. Names get lost like that, but follow they daughter Betsy. Follow the stories. Her grandchildren tell it. She washed her hair in first rain. On Mama's side, when one of great-grandma Josephine's 16 died, I wanted to know, how do you make dead tongues speak? Initial offering, gratitude, make space for what you ask, not as stranger as kin. And when you ask, be bound by blood. As for the talk part, the speak, notice the way sentient cinerariums carry the bones, the way they buzz between breath and letters, the bed of their humming in that one story. Mama talked about water breaking. She walked opposite of the hospital the night I came. Those bones, they started to chant in that other story. That story where they said,
I love how you play with the poem on this, on the page in this poem.
Thank you.
Ending on an unfinished word and an ellipses.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to, you know, talking about the difficulty of saying, of speaking history. I mean, partly it's because there's a lot you don't know, mm-hmm. on top of feeling unable to articulate, perhaps, and just the tradition of silencing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like that was a large part of why you wanted to write this poem and this book, to give voice to a lot of these things that hadn't had voice before?
I would say it was a combination between that, and it was also a combination between feeling like the mama who brung you, the first one. Originally, it was just that poem, like by itself. The other two hadn't existed yet. And I was thinking about like the thread of what it meant, like dreaming of mama, and like, you know, is it just the first level of mama? Is it grandmama? Is it great grandmama? And also thinking about, well, how do you end a story that really has no ending? And like you said, there are gaps. And then also thinking about what you can intuit if you only follow the thread.
Hmm.
There was some work I did on my critical thesis last year about Black literary epigenetics, because I wanted to think about epigenetics and things that are just passed down, even if you, let's say, didn't experience a Holocaust, but somehow the trauma just being in your bones, right, as a Jewish person. And so thinking about what does collective memory look like for a group of individuals where it's been ruptured a major rupture, uproot, scatter. But it's not necessarily that it's disappeared and gone. You can follow it in certain ways. And so that's the other piece that was the motivation here too, was—
You're talking follow it even internally, even in the psyche, not like go on, you know, 23andMe or something and like— Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Because I mean, there's that level of it, right? There's that level of, you can look for archival material, which is very important. I'm all about that. I love research. Then there's the other level where it's just like, what do your bones just know? Following that. But then what can't be said, or what are the blanks that you leave because maybe there's another part of the story undiscovered yet, or just kind of in the ether?
Maybe nothing, maybe definitely, you know, there's like, there's right. So much that's never going to be never even going to be possible to uncover. Right. And we wouldn't have it any other way. Right. So we need this level of unknown in there.
Yes.
And I think that's,
I love the tension. Yeah. I love the tension.
Yeah. It creates something for the reader to really step into. You know, even though you're writing about your own life and your own experience, and even like the Black experience, like I feel like a reader can really step into the poems, into the book, and like find themselves investigating as well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really like, I feel like when a whole book is doing that, it feels like a journey to read it. And I feel, you know, reading your book, I really feel like I'm learning about things, but I'm also like experiencing things with the speaker, and it's like a very mutual journey. Like I'm not being just talked. It's not a lecture, right?
Right.
It's participatory, and it's strange. And I think what I love so much about the way you're writing, is its strangeness a lot. And I think that you use a lot with music and the sounds of words and the sounds of speech, but it's, you know, and it's still got these narrative threads that keep coming back. But I get constantly surprised by what you do poem to poem. And that's it. That's all you can ask for in a fucking book, right?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, she had it right.
Like the poem's over. What?
Yeah.
Love it. I loved the just side note, totally don't have any like follow up on this, but I love Fugue Woke State as just like a title. Fugue Woke State.
Yes.
That it ends it. It's like I feel like that's what we're our country is going through right now.
Like, yes,
this is like I feel like woke state.
Yes. It's so true. Yeah. I mean, it feels often like as a artist, like almost like an in-between state, you know this, right? Like yeah. It where it's just like you're here physically, but then you're somewhere else, but then there's like that's how ghetto claustrophobia felt too, in thinking about what does that mean, and my ambivalence, even to be honest with you, like the ambivalence of using some of the vernacular that I use in the book and that I continue to use in my other work.
That, like what?
Well, it's you know, dropping certain endings of letters, like in the poem that I just read. Oh.
Yeah.
Or like what they call African-American English vernacular, Black mm-hmm. English vernacular. I resisted that for the longest time because I wasn't raised to speak that way. And then I feel right. some kind of way. And then being from Hartford, that's the other thing too. Like there's shame I have and from where the place I came from. And so like-
Shame, like, okay.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Or yeah, like just sort of like someone actually peeped it once because they were just like, you know, when you say Hartford, you say it almost like it's an apology. Like, because I'll say, oh, Hartford, Connecticut. Like not proud, not embracing. Yeah. Part of it having to do with the way.
I mean, it's not like New York where you're like.
No, you can't. No,
New
like,
York.
Right, New York. I'm from New York. Yeah. Right, yeah. I can't. Or Harlem, right? You can't.
Right.
And, I think the shame has grown with things like one time watching Gangland, whatever I was watching, because I love sometimes learning about gang culture and like the hierarchies and it's interesting to me. And then the beginning, they're like, we're taking you to Hartford, you know, Hartford, Connecticut, where there was a, you know, gang war between this gang and this gang. I'm like, what? And that was like when I was 12 and I didn't know anything about it because I was so sheltered. And so there's certain ways, and then poverty, that whole thing, having been homeless with my family, you know, losing the family home. So there's like this, there are pieces where I'm just sort of like, I think this was almost like a first pronouncement of owning it.
Yeah.
As opposed to trying to just say, no, that's not hiding it, because I deal with it in my prose, but like doing it on another level and bringing it in almost more intimately, because I view my poetry as intimate. I have an intimate relationship with it.
Right. It's very different in prose in that way.
Yeah.
There's something very, very linked to the internal world there more closely on the page. There's a lot of vulnerability, but thankfully there's also a lot of ambiguity.
Yeah,
there was another line I wrote down that was, what does unfamiliar feel like beyond the senses? And that line really spoke to me. There was something we come to find so unfamiliar about ourselves in poetry and in drama. It's weird. It's like almost like the more you investigate, the more you uncover, the more you start to understand when you're writing and researching and really becoming obsessed with something that is necessary to create a book, almost the more unfamiliar things feel, your own like self. Did you find that in creating this?
I did. Like, yeah. It was almost like I had to look back and be like, oh, I guess I am leaning into embracing playing with language in this way, or even a certain embrace of place, like, right? Because it's like, yeah. You can shun or be ashamed of something, but I must be embracing it by putting it in this book in such a way, in such a public way. And it did, like, I'm still surprised by the work in a lot of ways.
I love that.
And so, you know, it's like, and also it does feel unfamiliar, like where I'm like, wow, okay.
Yeah,
that's what I okay, and like continuing to still think about certain aspects of what I've put, because certainly my second and my third poetry manuscript that I'm working on right now, they don't look like this.
Mm-hmm.
They do something a little bit different. I would have to say this feels, I mean, it's personal in a different way, and it really vulnerability, like
mm-hmm.
what you had mentioned. Yeah, I would say, like, in a short answer, yes, it feels that way and did feel that way in putting this together. Like, I felt many times I was over my skis.
Yeah. It's true that too, like, looking back, and hopefully it'll keep happening, you know, years from now, you look back at this book and it'll still feel unfamiliar in different ways.
Yeah.
But it's a good thing because because you want to surprise yourself and not understand everything you're doing. Cause if you did, it would kind of suck. Like, I feel like I understand myself, but everything I understand, I hate. So, like, I really hope there's a lot more that is unknown that I don't understand. I don't know what I'm saying, but so too, that it's an undone investigation. Like, it's never going to be over. Like, of course you wouldn't have figured this out in 2 years, whatever it is. And that it will leak into other, books and projects that are coming in the future in many different forms. Cause you need, I mean, you understand this, you interview CFA, and worked in many different genres. So that, like, you start to understand that there's certain things you can do in certain genres that you can't do in other ones. So exploring and using whatever you have at your disposal to get at these things and teaching yourself that it's okay to do that is very liberating.
Yes. Like, the sense of permission where it's just sort of like, it feels natural as opposed to forcing a poem to end. It feels natural to just leave it that way. Or the interlude section, even like that, that was something that was way, I mostly like to create work where I'm like, I'm not sure necessarily where it's going.
Right.
And once I know where it's going, then I start to think about the other pieces and leave space for lots of surprise. Right. And with God's Thermostat Is Broke, it was funny because it was sort of like, that was from a prompt, and it was just sort of like, checking out VCFA. Yeah. And I was got this prompt. I was like, oh, I'll just, keep going with this. Oh, this is interesting.
Yeah.
I think I like what's happening. Let's just keep going.
Yeah.
And thinking about, well, if this is like a fugue woke state, and you're like somewhere between and betwixt wake and sleep and being, don't you have like an interlude where things are just kind of,
there's always going to be an interlude. That's so perceptive of you too, to be like accessing that spot and like writing that as well. I love that. I wanted to just ask you a little bit about your work in Vermont in the creative arts sector, projects that you're doing. Cause it sounded weird. I was talking about it with someone the other day, and it just sounds so interesting and so big and so ambitious. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, forgetting the name of it now, but you just had a meeting for it.
Oh, like, the Create Vermont.
Yes, Create Vermont.
Action plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that was a lot of fun. So was it like late February? It had to be somewhere in February, where the Vermont Arts Council, I had previously collaborated with them before to co-curate I Am, which was a show across many diversity of artists in Vermont. And from their newsletter, they started I Am Vermont Artists. So Amy at the Vermont Arts Council, Amy Cunningham, got in contact with me, and she's like, oh, if your dance card's up, well, would be interested working with her and a couple of lead consultants in creating this plan. Like, they already had many of these conversations over a few years, and then they had idea jam sessions over the fall, but then they reached out and they said, would you be interested in helping to write this plan? And it was like several days and weeks of conversations. We did something called March Madness, stakeholders from around the state, different levels.
And this is just to encourage the arts, the creative arts.
Yeah, like to encourage it, but also to talk about the way, like to take it seriously as, in the state of Vermont, like we're a main, like the creative sector is a main driver for a lot of jobs, for the economy.
Yeah.
And it was a way of looking at it strategically and saying, you know, how do we, let's say, reach across other sectors? How do we think about arts and business? How do we think about arts and education? Or not just arts, even like creativity, and not just thinking about the artists, but the fact that there are others across the creative sector doing so much work, even the individuals who are doing development work, cleaning the venues, the people who help us to enjoy the spaces we go into. And that was an interesting period, because here I was my last semester putting together my memoir. So writing that, still writing poetry, and then stretching in another direction. It's like, oh, let me think about the strategic planning and thinking around like goals and how do we encourage everyone to think about the creative sector. And not as just an add-on, you know, like,
right? Just like, we got to give a little bit of money to the arts, like, so that they can go write their poems, but like, it's not part of our infrastructure. Plus Vermont's been talking about how to get young people to stay here forever.
Yes.
And now here I am, moved back here, connecting with all these incredible young artists here, just making stuff happen. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, this is how we get people to stay here, you know?
Right.
I mean, so I'm so thrilled you're doing that. So thrilled.
And it's like, it's really exciting. And, you know, we've wrapped that piece of things up, but you're right about that. Like there is always missing what I would call, like, with my MBA hat on, succession planning for Vermont. And in terms of, you know, how do you hook these young people in to all the juiciness that's here and do it in ways that's just not tokenizing them, you know, like not just giving them a seat on some board where they have no real voice, but like the you know?
Yeah. Like really getting into it, and like, because it's beneficial, right? Like, so you have to understand that this is not just, it's not just a tokenizing move.
Right.
You're not just checking a box. Like,
right.
People have things to offer that will help everybody. Like, we're all going to benefit from this and like be better people and be a better state and be happier, which I think is the point, but.
I think that's the point too. Yeah. It's funny because like in thinking about the infrastructure, I've also been thinking about, you know, there's so many people around the state who've been doing this work, you know, the creative life work in their communities. And so, it just made sense to be a part of that. And I hope to, now I'm doing some stuff with VPR and doing some radio stuff. And I'm like, I'm gonna do more arts and culture at radio. I love that. And so the more I can amplify. And it's about also like, I think Vermont is so positioned, as I think about it, within New England, like, and New York, and like, you know, people come in and people go out, and how do we leverage that, right?
There's a lot, I mean, especially with COVID, like there's so much and before it already was there, but like now it's like even more so, like in and out, like New York, Vermont, like people, especially, and they're putting a new train thing in that go, it's like zooming to New York and back. I mean, it's just going to be like a pretty different vista coming up here. Pretty intense. And I want it to all be like, you know, I want it to be as like fruitful and exciting as possible, and not like a negative.
Right.
I don't know. You know, people used to be like, New Yorkers coming to vacation here.
Like, or they say that about Connecticut. I'm originally from Connecticut. People would be like, oh, Flatlanders. I'm like, what is that?
That whole Flatlanders thing. Like, oh, yeah, I'm so over it.
Yeah.
So before we go, I would love it if you just read us another poem from your beautiful book, Ghetto Claustrophobia.
All right. I think, you know what? Actually, I'm going to read the title poem. Partly because this was the way that I could encourage people to think about redoing the word ghetto so that it's not associated with a specific group of people or a specific culture.
Okay.
Ghetto claustrophobia. Whether place, people, state of mind, you be locked in until you don't want to be. Noun. Ghetto claustrophobics, also ghetto claustrophobes, ghetto claustrophobians. One, any group of people, they evade capture, they evade description. Two, identity, perceived or imagined. Noun, a place, ghetto claustrophobia. One, fashioned for but not by. Think characters, think props. Two, big, so big, expansive, endless. Three, any place. The place with the matching riding mowers. That place where cliques of moms go by the same name. Four, hotel room, apartment, house. Dreamscape, cityscape, rulescape, selfscape. Could be another country. Could be the human body as container, as shell, as place. From block to brick to burb to brownstone to any place, as in so many, as in endless. Five. These places, real and imagined, just like the people, they evade capture. Adjective, state of mind, states of being. Only an element if you want it to be. One, black girlhood in America. Two, nightmares. Three, stages of human development.
Chantilly Gander, thank you so much for coming and talking to me on the Roostone House podcast, for all that you're doing for Vermont, and for your, most of all, for your poems.
Thank you so much, Bianca. And like I said, honored and thrilled and love what you all are doing at the Roostone House.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.